With Chris Andre. Join us at 10:15. It'll be Flashpoints today, investigative news journalism with host Dennis Bernstein. Today, we'll hear more of Greg Palast talking about the election. At 11 on Between the Covers, we'll hear host Leanne Krantz speak with theoretical cosmologist and lecturer in astrophysics Roberto Trotta, author of the new book, The Edge of the Sky, All You Need to Know About All There Is. We will give away copies, a copy of the book at the end of the show, so do listen up. And at 11:30 on the Thursday morning radio zine, host Paul Rowland interviews Sar Naja, who plays the pioneering Nigerian musician and political activist Fela Kuti in the new documentary Finding Fela, which will premiere in Portland 1 week from today. That's all coming up, but join us next as we'll have our special hour-long edition of all... Perfogering show Fight the Empire. That is coming up next, so stick around. That's coming up right here on KBOO.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African high life, Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
Well, good morning. When I hear balalaikas and sleigh bells, I think of Teresa Mitchell, but she's on vacation today. So this is me, Per Fogring, filling in. This will be an hour-long press watch. So we are inviting phone calls at 503-231-8187. So I thought we'd start out by talking about the Ebola outbreak. People who listened to Stage and Studio last Tuesday, Dime Roberts had a guest from the Shake the Tree Theater Group, and they're putting on a stage version of Edgar Allan Poe's story, The Mask of the Red Death. And I haven't seen it. I just heard about the theater production. But the story goes that this sort of takes place in the Renaissance era. And there's a horrible plague known as a Red Death is going around the countryside. Well, the ruler, Prince Prospero, decides to hell with the people. He and his thousand lords and ladies and friends are going to hole up in his castle, and they will be safe while the Red Death wipes out all the people. So there they are in the castle. They are amply stocked with provisions and wine and everything. And he decides that one point after, I don't know, a few months of this, that they need some entertainment. So he has this kind of a masked ball. So everybody comes in costumes and masks, and you know, there's all sorts of entertainment and everything. And then they notice that here's this one of the guests is dressed as he's dressed as Red Death. He's got a sort of a funeral robe on and a mask of a sort of a corpse-like mask with blood spatters and everything. And really, the people are kind of horrified. And Prince Prospero challenges this guest, you know, to reveal himself. You know, he's spooking out all his friends, and they sort of but before he can do that, Prince Prospero drops dead, and then the guests, they attack this gruesome apparition. It turns out there's nothing inside his robes. It's a ghost. He is the Red Death, and they all die too. And the moral of this story is that you can, you know, when you have a plague going around, you can try and protect yourself and wall yourself off from all the victims, but it's not going to work. And so now we have this Ebola outbreak, which has been going through parts of West Africa, and it's really aroused a lot of fears, a lot of controversy as to which is the worst plague, the plague itself or the fears that it arouses. And you have a Republican politicians calling for banning air travel between here and West Africa and all sorts of things. Obama's kind of on the hot seat there. I think he's trying to do his best. And so there's this big fear about people, contagious people, coming into this country from West Africa or via or even through Mexico. And, you know, this is well, this may be a genuine fear in a way. You know, you can take precautions against the spread of this disease. And but what's being overlooked is that we put up these walls against people, but business as usual creates more victims. And what's happened is that I looked up the health budgets of various African nations, and it turns out that all the countries in West Africa, which includes the countries where Ebola has happened, and their health budgets are really, really low, lowest in Africa. I mean, just terribly low. Interestingly enough, the African country with the highest per capita health budget was Libya. But that was probably in the days before Colonel Gaddafi was overthrown and killed. I don't know what it is now. Libya is in such a mess. Civil war is going on there. But what it means is that these countries where the Ebola outbreak is happening are not, they're really hard put to fight it because their health budgets are so low. And there is a question, is how did they get that way? We know that you know, when a country goes into debt and can't pay its bills, the International Monetary Fund comes in and they bail, they give them a bridge loan, or they sort of carry over the loan or whatever. And but to do that, they demand that these countries trim their budgets, a sort of form of austerity. Well, the budgets that they usually trim are education or maybe infrastructure or health. They don't seem to trim their military budgets or whatever. So I don't have any actual figures on countries trimming their health budgets because of IMF. If anybody knows of that, give us a call at 503-231-8187. And we already have a caller. Joanne, you're on the air.
Yeah, as I talk to you, I have to deal with some of my old left-sided pains, but I'll do the best I can. Listen, I think this, even though there may be a lot more to it than I will ever know, I think the Ebola is being used as a distraction for many things, that are important things that are going on. And here's what I'm also thinking, that I may change my thinking. I am thinking that this Ebola is going to be used to, as well as radiation from Fukushima and other like things, to extinct undesirable people like myself who are considered mentally ill. But I'll get off the air, Pear. Thanks.
Well, I think Joanne is raising some interesting points that we've already seen how politicians and pundits are using this Ebola outbreak in various ways. You know, they're calling for halting air travel between West Africa and the United States. People are being confined, you know, with or without symptoms. There's some nurse who has been ordered confined, and she's fighting it in court, I believe, because she says she has no symptoms. She does not have Ebola. And so we have, you know, people who are up in arms about the border with Mexico. They are saying that not only are terrorists coming into this country through Mexico, but also we Ebola people, carriers of this horrible disease, is going to get us all if we don't put up walls, you know, just like Prince Prospero did, you know, put up walls around the United States, keep this epidemic out. Well, what happens is that when you slash health budgets, this epidemic arises, and not only in West Africa, things arise here too. I mean, you have parts of America, you know, where people are living in abject poverty. They have very little health care. And, of course, the politicians on the Republican side are screaming about Obamacare, so-called, which, as pitiful as it is better than what a lot of these people have. And so we see politicians using this kind of thing all the time. So an interesting thing about Ebola is that, and this is, since this is Press Watch, I've been reading a lot of the press, and the Ecologist magazine from actually today or yesterday has an article entitled Oil Palm Explosion Driving West Africa's Ebola Outbreak. And the what's happening is that in some countries, I think they mentioned Liberia, they're sort of clear-cutting forests and planting these oil palm plantations. And what this does, this disrupts the ecology. It kind of sent, you know, there are these bats that carry this disease, and they live in these forests, and you cut down the trees, and they look at these bats are looking for a new home. Well, maybe they fly into the cities or nearby villages or whatever. So that when you disrupt an ecology like that, you are wittingly or not helping this spread of this disease. And same thing applies, just good things like roads and transportation. Yes, you know, it used to be in the old days in Africa, you know, each village was more or less isolated. But with the roads and the global trade and everything, there's a lot of travel back and forth. And this one of the side effects of this is that diseases get spread. This happened with AIDS, you know, some years ago. Well, the health spending in Africa is really abysmal in some parts, and it's very interesting. I think Amy Goodman mentioned it on her show the other day that Guinea is spending more on debt than on public health. Think about that. Here's a country that is where people are dying of Ebola, and this country is spending more money to pay back debts. This money is going to the banks than they spend on public health to keep people alive. And sort of, we have another caller. Hi, Thomas, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning, Pear. Yeah, I think this Ebola situation is sort of a bellwether and an exemplary of certain massive dysfunction and disequity, not just in relation to medical issues or public health issues, but in relation to the priorities of international finance and capital and foreign policy. You know, I mean, it's no secret that the IMF and the World Bank have been widely criticized ever since their creation, since World War II, as essentially being international loan sharking operations that maximally benefit the bottom line of U.S. and European banks mostly. And, of course, you know, you talk about the budgets for healthcare, and particularly budgets for preventative health. And any sort of public health agenda has to come directly up against the demands placed upon a country's economy by structural adjustment and payback loan payback requirements for these countries. So a lot of times it's not even so much the direct request, though often it is, of the IMF or the World Bank to cut back the health budgets, but it's becomes a matter of fiscal almost necessity for the countries to do it because they have so much money that they have to pay back to the debtor banks. And remember, you know, people might ask, well, gee whiz, why would these countries take out these loans and take this money they have to pay back with these, you know, this odious, this usurious interest? And the fact is that that fits hand in glove with the larger part of the policy, which is usually, you know, attendant with the United States and Western countries backing up autocrats and dictators with intelligence, military, and other supports, so that they are, in fact, you know, rigging elections. So, in fact, we have essentially our people in those countries doing the bidding. And, yeah, so the last thing that happens is support for public health. And you want to talk about the issue of affordable drugs in these countries. For you know, a good example would be the African countries and their plight of AIDS. You have pharmaceutical companies that are where people spend thousands and thousands of dollars a year in these antiretroviral drugs in Western countries, and they don't want to let it go. You know, they've been extremely hesitant to let them go in the third world. So, you know, it comes right back down to greed again. And incidentally, Cuba, which sent the largest number of doctors so far, the small island country of Cuba, to the Ebola-stricken region, has some of the highest, I think maybe the highest health indicators of all of Latin America, and has for some time, and of course on a tiny budget. And as far as you mentioned Libya, well, you know, the United Nations Human Development Index listed Libya under Gaddafi as being the highest. So all the basic access to education, to health care, and so forth, and foods. So, you know, there's a whole other narrative, and it's called dependency theory. If you look up, and underdevelopment is a term, is an academic term that describes what's done to these countries. And my big fear with Africa, not just the fact that this terrible disease can spread due to the poverty and the lack of health care, but, you know, another fear is that this is just going to be played by the United States and West in a very, in a shock doctrine-like fashion, you know, the term coined by Naomi Klein, where in the aftermath of the draining of the public coffers and unrest, this is going to be used as a Trojan horse excuse for the United States and the West to put even more military pressure and presence in these mineral-rich areas.
It could be, yeah. Well, you know, that whole thing was described very well in that book by John Perkins, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And he tells about how he actually, his business, his job was to try and get leaders of these countries to take out loans. And once you do that, it's very hard to pay them all back. And it's and if they don't want to take the loan, then they are encouraged in other ways. And so this is the thing.
That's right.
You know, you have the country's in debt like that, and they are, you know, you can say, well, we'll forgive a little bit of debt if you vote our way in the UN, or you allow military bases, or you do this thing or that thing. And then the money that's loaned, a lot of times it goes to the rulers and the wealthy, and they stash their money in a Swiss bank someplace. Wow. And
that's right. And indeed, you know, it's a mistake to think that these are aberrations or flaws in an otherwise well-intentioned system.
That's right. No, it is a system.
That's right. It is the system. It's a specifically created system, and indeed with this amount of leverage, you can always get a country to toe the line of the desired policy, because all you have to do is, the second that it deviates from it, you isolate it with all of its similarly, you go to all of its similarly indebted neighbors, and you put pressure on them to isolate them economically. So really, this has been the formula for 50 years, and what it, you know, and the net result is cheap mineral goods and agricultural goods transferred, and now manufactures to rich Western countries, and countries that are completely politically and economically dependent upon the United States. So really, it's like an international mafia. And you know, here in the United States, I think we should use this as an object lesson with this Ebola thing, and that our budgets have been cut, and our preventative health has been cut so far to the bone due to privatized medicine, that if we ever have a serious outbreak of something like a swine flu, again, a really deadly swine flu, or something akin to the bird flu epidemic of 1918, we're not going to have the hospital beds, we're not going to have the healthcare personnel or anything, then we're really going to have a problem. So I think that we should learn from this maximally now, both in terms of the global health consequences, but also just questioning the flawed economic order, and perhaps going forward, this new BRICS bank, this new development bank that is being sponsored by, of course, Brazil, Russia, South Africa,
China,
India and China.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So this could become the beginning of a change in some of these odious policies of international loan sharks.
Well, maybe I'll get into that a little bit later, but thanks for your call. You know, we have a sick system in more ways than one. I was going to... Harry, you are on the phone. Hi.
Oh, hey. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I've noticed that no one's really doing anything. The good solution, considers West Africa, is to send hospital ships. Now, Obama, under his command, he has the U.S. Navy and other departments has hospital ships he could send to the area. And why he should do this is because, like, Liberia was created by the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a vested interest to help them. And I'm thinking about back in the 60s, there used to be advertisements of the good ship Hope.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
Remember, they used to go to different countries and help them out. And I was thinking, well, we have all that. We can send them right away. All the president has to do is say something.
Well, that's interesting. Right now, I think we have our Army guys building hospitals. I don't know how long that will take. Cuba actually has medical people in these countries. And I understand from what I've been reading lately is that some of these countries have actually succeeded in kind of, they say, maybe turning the corner on this thing. They have reduced the number of Ebola cases, you know, in various ways. So
yeah, and I think the UN also has hospital ships and can deliver supplies and things, and you just don't hear the UN really doing anything.
Well, I don't know. I mean, of course, a lot of the Ebola is occurring in kind of remote communities inland and not near any seaport or anything. I don't know if that has anything to do with it.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, by seaport, you can always, you know, fly from there.
That's
true.
Drop
supplies, you know, take trucks and go to the areas that you need to go to. So.
Well, thanks for your call.
Okay.
I think now I'd like to talk a little bit about Islamic State, or ISIS, or whatever you want to call it. It seems to have several different names. And, you know, this is a huge topic, you know, this outbreak of talk about extreme Islamic jihadi rebels. It's sort of unprecedented, but people wonder where did a group like this come from? Well, there are lots of different ways. There's a very interesting article by Nafiz Ahmed. He lives in London. He's an English writer, And he has an article, How the West Created the Islamic State. It's rather a long article. I can't go into the whole thing, but you can find it under truthout.org. And or just do a web search on Nafeez, N-A-F-E-E-Z, Ahmed, H-M-A-H-M-E-D. Really worth reading. He's a young guy, but he's a real scholar. And one thing we can do is, you know, when we think about all these things breaking out in the Middle East or anywhere in the world for that matter, you know, it's like coming into a movie. You know, you come in the middle of a movie and you see violence going on and you try and figure out, how did this happen? Who started it? Who's to blame? Well, we tend to do that when we talk about things happening in the world. You know, our memory goes back maybe a few years. It goes back to 9/11, 2001. But when you're talking about the Middle East, I think we need to go back a little bit further. We don't have to go back to ancient times in the Roman Empire or the Crusades. We can go back, just go back to World War I, which is actually just 100 years ago. And that's where a lot of this stuff started. You know, World War I was between the imperial powers, with Britain, France, Russia, and the U.S., and Italy on one side, Germany, Austria, Hungary, and the Ottomans on the other. Now, all those nations were empires. They had their colonies mostly in Africa. Well, during that war, Colonel Lawrence was sent by the Brits, you know, to instigate a rebellion among the Arabs against the Ottoman Empire. And he promised the Arabs that if they could get rid of the Ottomans, that they would be that they would become free nations. And I think he believed it himself. It turned out that he was being used. And what happened was the Ottomans were defeated, and what happened, instead of getting freedom, these countries were turned over to England and France. They kind of divided up the spoils. And Colonel Lawrence's allies was this Sharif Hussein, and his two sons, Abdullah and Faisal, were made kings of Jordan and Iraq. And so that is where a lot of this stuff happened. The Arabs were betrayed during World War I. Also during World War I, England invaded Mesopotamia, which is now Iraq, and that was in 1916. You also had the Balfour Declaration, where Britain decided that Palestine, or at least a portion of Palestine, should be given as a homeland to the Jews. And they also made a similar promise to the Arabs, apparently. And the first governor of Jerusalem, a man named Sir Ronald Storrs, said, in talking about this deal, about a Jewish state, he said, quote, "It will form for England a little loyal Jewish Ulster in a sea of potentially hostile Arabism." In other words, he saw it as a kind of like the way Northern Ireland was used to divide and rule Ireland. Well, this went on, you know, during this rebellion in Mesopotamia. Winston Churchill, who was the president of the British Air Council, said, quote, "I do not understand the squeamishness about the use of gas. I am strongly in favor of using poisonous gas against uncivilized tribes," by whom he meant the tribes of Mesopotamia. Well, then Mesopotamia became a British territory, was renamed Iraq, with their king installed. And this went on, you know, through the war years, through World War II. And then, you know, World War II and the Holocaust made a lot of the Jews who survived were homeless. And they were encouraged to go to Palestine when they took a lot of the land there. In the meantime, Syria had an elected government in 1949. They had an elected government. CIA backed a coup that kicked out that ruler, replaced him with military rulers. Then later on in 1953, the U.S. and Britain, they got rid of Iran's President Mossadegh, and the Shah came back. Well, in 1959, the CIA hired a young thug named Saddam Hussein to assassinate the president of Iraq, Abdul Karim Qasem. That attempt failed, but Saddam Hussein escaped. Later on, a few years later, Qasem was overthrown, and he was executed on TV, apparently. And the Ba'athist Party killed with a hit list provided by the U.S., they killed at least 3,000 leftists. So you wonder why do so many people in the Middle East hate the U.S. and the West in general? It does go back to the Crusades, but it's sort of been replayed in just the 100 years since World War One. And one of the things that's happened is that in some of these examples I gave you, the secular left was removed. The Western powers decided that the secular left, which might include communists, socialists, or whatever, they were a danger, and they were assassinated or removed from office, and the Islamists were favored. Now, why? Apparently, under some U.S. leaders, it was thought that, they are religious. The secular leaders were godless communists, unquote, but the Islamists were religious. And maybe they'd be easier to deal with, or maybe they thought it'd be easier to betray them. All this is written about in that article by Nafiz Ahmed that I told you about. So anyway, that is sort of the background of the Islamic State. One example in Afghanistan back in 79, Zbigniew Brzezinski decided it'd be a great idea to get the Soviets to invade Afghanistan and give them a taste of what Vietnam was like for the U.S. And so they began arming the Mujahideen, so-called freedom fighters, who sort of later evolved into Al-Qaeda, which later evolved into Islamic State. And so that is the background of where this bunch of fanatical kind of Islamic fascists came from. They were set on their path, encouraged by the West. And of course, now they have turned against the West, we think. Who knows what's really going on there? I don't know. A lot is made of, the Islamic State. They behead people, they have these sort of public executions where they cut off people's heads on TV. I don't want to watch that kind of stuff, but it's available for those who want to see it. And so a big thing is made out of this horrible way of executing people. Well, let's stop and think a while. They're not the only ones who behead people. In fact, our ally, Saudi Arabia, does the same thing. If you go to downtown Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia, there is a place which is known as Chop Chop Square. And that's where they have executions, public executions. They bleed somebody in, kneel down, and the guy with a sword runs up and whack, off goes his head. So that is one of our allies. There's probably beheaded a lot more people than Islamic State. We also might say that the Mexican drug gangs have been beheading people for a number of years. And it's a very interesting thing I read about quite a while ago, a beheading that happened in El Salvador. During the rebellion there, and the U.S. Supported death squads were running things, and the story was that there was a farm family, and the husband and two older sons are out working in the fields, and the mother in the family maybe was bringing their lunch to them. And so while she was gone, the younger kids and her mother were in the house. Well, the woman brought the lunch to her husband and older sons, and when she got back to the house, she saw the younger kids and her mother sitting at the table in the kitchen, but their heads were on the table in front of them. And the death squads had been there while she was gone, and they were sort of being artistic about this. They had cut off these people's heads, put them on the tables, and then sort of arranged the corpses so that their hands were resting on their heads. And so this happened back in the 80s, and this was done by the death squads that the U.S. was promoting in El Salvador. So when you hear about Islamic State beheading people, think of that. Might also ask if you had to die, would you rather be beheaded or would you rather be hit by a white phosphorus bomb? What a choice. One thing about beheading, it's over. And white phosphorus is not over at all. It takes a long time. White phosphorus, it burns your body. It cannot be washed off with water. Apparently, water just makes it burn even more intensely. And we and other nations use white phosphorus bombs all the time. Well, anyway, now we have Islamic State, and they've kind of rampaged through Iraq and Syria. It's interesting that Iraq as a nation was put together by the West after World War I. They sort of took three provinces of the old Ottoman Empire and combined them into Iraq, and they did that for tactical, for strategic reasons, and now apparently we are dismembering Iraq for similar reasons. And so there's this one writer, Peter Van Buren, talks about an article called The Seven Worst Case Scenarios That Can Happen in this whole sort of a Middle Eastern war that's going on. One is that a powerful Kurdistan emerges. This is another thing that happened after World War I. The Kurds were supposedly promised a nation state of their own. But what happened was that the Turkish ruler, Kemal Ataturk, decided that he raised a huge objection. And so the West listened to him, and so the Kurds were kind of apportioned among these other nations that were created. Like Kurds live in southeast Turkey, they live in Syria, Iraq, and Iran. And they've been sort of struggling for their own nation ever since. Now they sort of have one. It's not official, but it's sort of there, and they're actually conducting business. There are different Kurdish factions, which is very interesting, because you have, you have the Peshmerga troops, which are sort of the Iraqi Kurds. And there are two factions. One is very pro-West, another was sort of allied with Iran. But then you have, right now there's a battle going on in this town of Kobani near the Turkish border. And the Kurds are fighting Islamic State. And these are the Kurds of the PKK, which has been labeled a terrorist group. They are a Marxist group that has been fighting Turkey, and they have their own kind of area called, I think, Rojava, which is a sort of, from what I understand, is kind of a democratic place among these Kurdish fighters. Women are fighting along with the men. They have all the rights of men, and they... one thing I read is that they're really kind of frightening the Islamic State warriors, who have been, they have this religious belief that if they die fighting a woman, they don't go to heaven, they go straight to hell. So when they see a woman fighter coming at them, it kind of puts the fear of the deity into them. So we have a caller on the line. Jack is on the line. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Per. Again, important subjects, and you always, these shows draw some interesting commentary. Tomas and Harry are both making really important comments, and you mentioned Nafis Ahmed, who I've been reading for several years in various publications, and he's always insightful. My comment is that people seem to be a little bit too forgiving about the way this stuff is going. We often hear about failures. Okay, failures. Well, my take on it is that it's all planned, and that basically the only failures are the intention to fail these self-determinant states. In your history, you I can't remember if you recall if you mentioned Nasser or not.
No, I didn't.
But Nasser was a secularist who stood up and with a very self-determinant agenda to make Egypt basically to develop Egypt in a way that was much freer than what the West had in mind. And the Muslim Brotherhood, it's well known by now that the Muslim Brotherhood was created by MI6 in order to destabilize Egypt and to get rid of Nasser. And it continues. This kind of thing continues. We, it's no different than what we saw with the Mujahideen.
Mm-hmm.
And the analysis that now Al Qaeda and now ISIS is all blowback and failure, intelligence failures. I take exception with that. I see all of this as intelligence successes.
Well, people might argue with that. I think that's an open question. I've read articles where they claim that, all this chaos is exactly what the West wants, that it's easier to rule an area and get the oil when there's chaos. And I don't know about that. I mean, it's... I think it's a topic that's worth discussing. That's for sure.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, to get the oil, you don't have to take the oil. You can always just buy it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and certainly that's really a lot easier. But the point that Tomas brought up about the IMF and the World Bank putting the third world into horrible debt servitude is, I think that's the crux of it. And any Nasserist type leader in the Middle East who it appears really wants to protect his population from the ravages of the global finance oligarchy, his days are numbered. We saw Gaddafi. Who was widely demonized, and yeah, he had quirky features, and he was demonized for being brutal against his opposition. But what we got now is far worse.
Gaddafi was kind of brutal. At the same time, the West used him too. I mean, seems to me Tony Blair was palling up to Gaddafi at one time. So it's.
and so was Sarkozy. I mean, so at any rate, these guys are usable and expendable. And it was clearly pointed out that that Libya had the highest standards of Africa, and Gaddafi had plans to help develop the neighboring countries and the sub-Saharan Africa with Libyan wealth and technology, and to help get water to them as well. He had this incredible water system. And what does NATO do? They bomb this water system. They break it, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And so I mean, so my analysis is simply that the goal is to get rid of self-determinant leaders who stand in the way of the IMF World Bank agenda, and to fail these states and to make them so dependent on this banking system, this international system of central banks, that it leads the way to corporate excesses. Naomi Klein, for all the good work she does, disaster capitalism is an interesting theory, but I think it's just too forgiving. I think there's more planning involved than people are willing to acknowledge. You're right. It's a whole subject unto itself for another day, probably.
Yeah. Well, thanks for your call. Well, actually, the system itself is kind of like it's offering a lifeline to drowning people on a sinking ship. So, as far as this article just came out just the other day, it's in a magazine called The Business Insider, and basically saying that U.S.-led airstrikes are leading al-Qaeda to reach out to Islamic State. Now, we've been hearing that that Islamic State was just too brutal, even for al-Qaeda, and that they were kicked out. Well, apparently, al-Qaeda may sort of get back, join up with the Islamic State once more. So anyway, that is a very interesting development. We have another call. Francis, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I've been listening to this conversation. I appreciate your conversation a lot. And I haven't spoken about Muammar Gaddafi too much, but I am really disheartened by the activities of our country in my name, by the CIA and all the things that they're stirring up there. And I feel like a lot of it has to do with what you just said and your caller just said, about control of resources. And what happened in Libya is really heartbreaking. Like you said, after the bloodless coup in, I think it was 1969, Muammar Gaddafi proceeded to bring all the wealth that was his country's, he brought it to the people. And if you read his Green Book, I don't know if you've heard of that.
Yeah, I have, yes.
He has a whole very thoughtful way of approaching politics and everything. And the way he was portrayed in the West is, to me, scandalous. Because of who he was and how he represented the people and the people of Africa, actually.
Mm-hmm.
He and his son had established a conflict resolution institution, and it was all about peaceful conflict resolution. Right?
Mm-hmm.
All of that has been wiped away by what we did in Libya.
That's true.
In the name of something for some rebels or something. I don't know who we decided we were going to defend in that situation.
I don't know who. You have about, I don't know how many different factions are fighting it out in Libya.
Right now,
mm-hmm.
because the government has been destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And as your caller just said, the water system, this was an amazing water system. There were aquifers discovered in the desert, in the Sahara Desert.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Pure, beautiful water.
Because in
spite of our sanctions on his country, he was able to build a man-made river that brought water to Tripoli and all the coastal towns, and cities that were brown turned green, but that's all been destroyed.
Mm-hmm. Well,
for what purpose exactly?
Well, I don't know.
I think for someone to control the oil and the resources there and the water, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's criminal.
It is. It is. Yes.
But I don't know what anybody's going to do about it.
Well, I don't know.
What can we do about it except talk about it? But powers that be are doing what they do.
Well, we can learn about it, and maybe we'll have a chance to actually do something about it sometime. Anyway, thanks for your call.
Thanks.
One thing I'd like to bring up, we're talking about building walls and things. This is an article from the Jerusalem Post. October 27th. And it's The headline is Defending Israel's Borders from Climate Refugees. And it starts out, to combat increased waves of illegal migration that will likely accompany climate change, Israel must secure its borders with impassable barriers, including, quote, sea fences along the Mediterranean and Red Seas, experts have concluded. Quote, the lack of water, warming, and sea level rise, even if it will occur on a different schedule, will bring migration movements from all impoverished regions to every place where it is possible to escape this, wrote a team of academics led by Professor Amon Soffer and Dr. Anton Berkovsky of the University of Haifa. So this is very interesting. You know, these academics and apparently a lot of people in Israel are realizing that you know, the climate change is really affecting the Middle East, and there's going to be a lot of refugees, and they are talking about building a barrier to keep them out. In other words, totally walling in Israel. Of course, once they decide where they're going to build the wall, which means actually delineating their borders, but they're talking about a wall, including some kind of a sea fence. I'm not sure how that would work. But this is sort of on their minds. Well, it's interesting that they're talking about keeping out climate refugees, but there's no way that you can keep out the climate itself. And I have seen maps sort of predicting you know, what the Middle East will be like, say, in 2050 or 2100, you know, the rest of this century. And it's really horrendous. I mean, right now, you know, like summertime temperatures go up to 125 or whatever, and that this is going to get worse as the climate heats up. And so I have seen these maps. Sort of the worst spots that I can pick out are sort of around Iraq and Syria, but that is right next door to Israel. So Israel cannot escape this global climate change. And yes, they can keep out the refugees, but what do they do about the climate itself? This is sort of kind of a horribly ironic thing, is that you know, that for a lot of people, Israel is a promised land, but it may turn out to be more like Death Valley, you know. And it's not just the summertime heat, which already is pretty bad in the Middle East, but there's also the water problems. You know, climate change brings droughts, and it also brings rising oceans, you know, which is kind of like a double whammy. You have the water where you don't want it, and you don't have the water where you need it. And so the way things are going as climate-wise, Israel, like the rest of the Middle East, may become more and more unlivable all the time. And I think that Israel is having a problem with people emigrating already. There was recently a strange little affair where an Israeli guy who was living in, he was in Berlin, wrote some article or he did a blog or something on the internet about how the price of chocolate pudding in Berlin is very low compared to the price of chocolate pudding in Israel. I guess that's a favorite dish among Israelis. And he was saying that, hey, if you want to really live better, come to Germany, come to Berlin. And got a lot of people in Israel very, very well. A lot of people in Israel are going to Berlin. The Jewish population in that city has really increased a lot in the last number of years. But this became a big controversy in Israel that this guy was regarded as kind of practically a traitor, because he was advocating not just Jews coming to Israel, but Jews leaving Israel. And so the last I heard was that he sort of decided that he was going to go back to Israel himself. So I'm not sure how that whole thing is going to turn out. But it's interesting that that it aroused such a big firestorm. And apparently there's another group of Israeli kind of expatriates who have decided that that Warsaw is a better place to live than either Israel or Berlin. So this is a and as the Middle East heats up and becomes more and more unlivable, I think you're going to find a lot of people will be moving away from from that region. So another little interesting development in Israel was a U.S. official was quoted as calling, well, he called Bibi Netanyahu a name that we cannot utter on radio. It can be printed, which is always wondered. I've always wondered about that. How can you print this these words, but you can't say them on the air? But anyway, this high official in the U.S. was interviewed in Atlantic Magazine by a very well-connected writer, and he called Netanyahu. Well, the word he used was chicken droppings, shall we say, chicken droppings. You know what the word is. We use it all the time. And so it was meant he was really angry. I guess the high officials in Washington are really ticked off at Netanyahu because he's gone out of his way to snub them. So it's getting very strange there. So and Netanyahu was publicly labeled as a chicken bleep, and meant in a sort of as being a coward. Well, that's one use of that term. I remember it was also used as sort of dealing with kind of nitpicky regulations in the army and stuff like that. Well, anyway, this. Kind of aroused another little firestorm in Israel. And then it raised a problem is the Israeli press were wondering, how do you translate this word into Hebrew? And they, you know, they came up with different versions, Haaretz just... Well, Israel Hayom explained that the word meant coward, and Haaretz added a little bit that it meant a pathetic coward. And so the Israeli press has been going around about how do you translate this word into Hebrew. I could give you the Hebrew translation, but who knows, the FCC might decide that that is also not fit to utter on the air, because you know, from what I understand about FCC regulations, why you cannot just you know, you have the seven deadly words, but you can't just translate them into some other language and get away with it that way either. In fact, some people say you can't even hint at it the way I am doing. So I don't know, it's a murky situation, to say the least. But there we are. And so this has been an extended version of Press Watch with myself filling in for Teresa, who is on vacation, who should be back next week. And I've been really, it's been great talking to you and hearing your calls and everything. And I want you to stay tuned to KBOO, because there is stuff you get on KBOO you will not hear elsewhere on the dial. So that is why this is your radio station. It's your radio station. All you have to do is become a member of the KBOO family, and this station is yours as much as it is mine or anybody else's. And we need, especially in times like this, We need a station like this. So thanks for listening, and stay tuned for Cascadia. Yes.
Air Cascadia.
Air Cascadia. We're on the air, aren't we still? Thanks for listening.
That's right, Air Cascadia is coming up in just a couple minutes. And you are listening to an hour-long edition of Press Watch, hosted by Per Fogren. Glad to finally get that right, a couple minutes before 10 o'clock. Join us in 15 minutes for Flashpoints, Investigative News Journalism with host Dennis Bernstein. Today we'll hear more of Greg Pallas talking about the election. At 11 o'clock on Between the Covers, we'll hear host Leanne Krantz speak with theoretical cosmologist and lecturer in astrophysics Roberto Trotta about his new book, The Edge of the Sky, All You Need to Know About the All There Is. We'll be giving away a copy of the book at the end of the show, so do listen up. And at 11:30 on the Thursday morning radio zine, host Paul Rowland interviews Sar Naja, who plays the pioneering Nigerian musician and political activist Fela Kuti in the new documentary Finding Fela, which will premiere in Portland 1 week from today. That is all coming up right after Air Cascadia. It's Chris Andre up next on KBOO Portland.
I'm Rusty Butler, a Siletz tribal member. I got in trouble with the law when I was 14 years old and spent my teenage years behind the bars. My culture and traditions helped me find my way. I now work with the Siletz youth in my community. Hear my story on Prison Pipeline, November 3rd at 6:30 p.m.
Nanta Shri Nagi Thai, Nanta Ha Ha Ha, Nanta Ha.